Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, we're kicking off our summer reading series with a Conversations Live favorite, international thriller and New York Times bestselling author, Steve Berry. Today, we introduce a new lead character in a standalone novel, The Omega Factor. It has all the suspense and thrills that you've come to expect from Steve's books, along with art, history, conspiracies, and deeply held secrets that people will kill for, including what I'm going to call ninja nuns and their nemesis, the Vatican. Well, Steve Berry is the number one internationally best-selling author of 16 Cotton Malone novels, 5 standalone thrillers, and several works of short fiction. He has 25 million books in print and was a founding member of International Thriller Writers. He's an emeritus member of the Smithsonian Library's Advisory Board, and his latest book is The Omega Factor. And here's my guest, Steve Berry. Steve Berry, welcome back to the show. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, I'm always excited to talk to you, but, you know, it's always great to have a brand new character to talk about, and that's what we're talking about today, because you, I think for the first time in 10 years, have published a standalone book. Has it been that long?
It has been. It was 2012 with The Columbus Affair was my last standalone, and in between, I did a bunch of Cotton Malones. I've done 16 Cotton Malones total, and I switched publishers about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and they wanted to start off with a standalone, which was a little bit of an issue because I'd already written the next Cotton Malone book, finished and done. So, but they wanted to start with that, so that's fine. I had this character in my head. He's been in my head for a long time. He's a guy that works for UNESCO at the United Nations in a division called CLIO, which is like the Muse of History, the Cultural Liaison Investigative Office, and he's their boots on the ground. He goes around and protects cultural treasures around the world, and I've been thinking about him for a long time. I wanted to do something with him, but I just didn't get the opportunity, so this allowed me to bring Nick Lee to life, and this is the book where you get to meet him, and it's similar to Cotton in that it's action, history, secrets, conspiracies. It's different because Nick and Cotton are very different people.
Right. He's a younger character, right?
He's younger than Cotton, but older than Luke Daniels, who's the younger guy in my series. So he's right in the middle there. He has different motivations, different background. He has a family, brothers and sisters, parents. He has a history with a particular woman. There's a lot of things with him that are very different than Cotton. And it was fun to explore a new personality.
Yeah, and like all of your books, you travel the globe here. The story begins, it actually begins in the prologue begins in 1428 in the Pyrenees Mountain. The chapter one begins in present day in Ghent, Belgium. And I know for many of your stories you do travel, but he's been called there by a Facebook message by his former fiance and goes over there, and that's where the adventure begins, right?
Yeah, that's right. He has a background and a history with this woman, and it's the first time they've seen each other in a long time. And when he gets there, trouble has started, and he's thrust into the middle of this trouble. And she basically left him. They were going to marry, but she decided not to because she had a calling and she wanted to be a nun, and that's what she did. She became a nun. And so this book explores some interesting aspects of the Catholic Church. I thought I was kind of done with the Catholic Church. I'd done 4 books dealing with Catholic Church issues, but I came across something that had not been dealt with very much in fiction, and it was fascinating. It was interesting and a little fresh and different, so I decided one more time.
Yeah, so let's talk about that a little, because you are known for finding these little-known pieces of history and putting a lot of the history in your book, but also adding a little fiction and tweaking it here and there when you need to. And this kind of centers around the Ghent altarpiece, which I Googled, and what a stunning piece of work that is. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I saw it about 6 years ago when I was there doing the research on the Warsaw Protocol. I went to Bruges to see the Cathedral of the Holy Blood. It gets about a half hour away, and I'd never heard of the altarpiece, to be honest with you. It was new for me, and I went over there and saw it, and it is, as you say, stunning. It is now fully restored. At that time, they were just getting into the restoration, but now all the panels have been restored. It is stunningly beautiful. It was not the first oil painting ever done, but it is one of the first oil paintings to ever maximize the use of oil. This painting was done in the 1430s. Oil was brand new, and oil allows depth. Oil allows detail. Oil allows all kinds of things you can't do with watercolors and other pigments that they would use. And Jan van Eyck, who painted the altarpiece, made maximum use of that. He was a miniaturist. He could paint very small. And the altarpiece is loaded with small, tiny details all through it. And it was years to come up with a way to use the altarpiece, but I couldn't make it work. And then finally, when I was putting this book together, it happened.
So let's talk about how it fits into the story a little bit, because Kelsey, Nick's former fiance, is restoring that, and there's a lot of mystery around it. There are two conflicting sides, and I'm going to call them ninja nuns, because that's what they kind of came across to me. And I was so hoping these were going to be real, but they were part of the fiction that you added. So tell us about these two conflicting sides who don't want the secret to be told around
us. Well, I wanted a group of nuns who would be a little bit extraordinary. I did want them to be a little different, and I wanted them to be, I don't know, it's hard to explain. I was taught by nuns, so I wanted them to be extraordinary, very much so. And so I created them, and they harbor secret. They've kept a secret for 2,000 years. And they're protecting this secret. They're protecting the church and protecting trying to do it without giving anything away. It's hard.
It's hard, don't give any spoilers.
I don't want to give anything away. It's really cool, actually. It's a surprise in the novel that comes out of it, because I don't foreshadow this. And it comes up about halfway to three-quarters of the way through the book. So I want the reader to be surprised.
Right. So let's talk about what we can talk about without spoiling anything. And that's the character Nicholas Lee, who you say had been in your head for a long time. How did he first appear to you, and how did he develop, and what made him the right character for this particular story?
Well, the more simple answer is, they wanted to stand alone with a brand new person. But what made this guy good for it was that, he had the connections working with UNESCO and with the United Nations, and he gets drawn in to this as this national treasure of Belgium. So it worked very well from the standpoint of the treasure being, the painting itself being a national treasure, and then the UNESCO's job is to protect all of that, so it fit nicely. And that's what began to come together as I began to put these elements together of the story, and it did come together nicely. And I was able to finally figure it out. It took me 6 years to figure out what to do with the altarpiece. The problem is the altarpiece has been studied to death. There's no surprises in there. So I had to work with what was there. Mm. And I came up with it.
Right. And so Nick's job with the Cultural Liaison and Investigative Office, or CLIO, I read in the back of the book that CLIO is a play off the goddess or the muse of history.
Yes.
That's interesting. How did that come to you?
I'm just kind of lucky, to be honest with you. I was trying to come up with something clever, like the Magellan billet that I had with Cotton Malone, and that kind of came to me in like a moment's notice, Magellan billet. And so I was looking for something clever, and I don't know, I just stumbled across CLIO, and I saw the word CLIO, and I went, whoa, that's pretty interesting, CLIO, Muse of History, that kind of fits. And then I had to figure out Cultural Liaison Investigative Office,
Right.
And I just was was able to put it together. It's just one of those things you do, you know, when you're trying to conceive something. You want a name, you want it clever, but you also want it relevant.
Right. It sounds like there would be a need for this particular role, actually. It sounds like it should be a real job.
Is out there, for all I know. I haven't actually checked. They may have cultural investigators who deal with cultural treasures.
Mm.
I never really went and looked. I just kind of made the whole thing up.
So when you were doing your research, the Ghent altarpiece, which is also known as the Adoration of the Mystic Lamb, I understand.
Yes.
The most violated work of art in the world, vandalized, dismantled, or stolen 13 times. Why do you think this was the most vandalized, most attacked piece?
Nobody knows at this point. It's an interesting question. It's what kind of drew me to it, is why have so many people stolen this work of art? Why have so many people wanted to own this work of art? Why have so many people vandalized or attacked it? It was, you know, the 12th panel, one of the panels of the altarpiece was stolen in 1934. It's never been seen since.
Mm.
And that's all dealt with in the novel. Hitler took the entire altarpiece in World War II. And that's what the movie The Monuments Men was all about.
Oh, okay.
They were after the Ghent altarpiece.
Yeah.
And you see it at the end of the movie when they brought it back. And they actually did find it and returned it to Belgium.
Mm. So that you say in the writer's notes at the back of the book, which is always one of my favorite things, whatever book I'm reading, I always like to read the writer's notes, I guess because I'm a bit of a nerd. But you do separate fact from fiction there, which I think is also very important. You say that the restoration the work you talk about in the book is actually true. I'm wondering, when I was Googling this picture, this painting, because I'd never heard of it before, I saw the restoration of the central panel of the lamb. I was wondering if you had seen that. There's a lot of controversy around it.
When I was there, the central panel had not been done yet, but now it is finished and complete. You can see all of this on a wonderful website called Closer to Van Eyck, where they have high-resolution images of the entire altarpiece, both before and after the restoration. And it's quite spectacular. I mean, the thing now really just shines. When I was there, about half of it had been restored, and they were about to start the center panel. But now it's finished, so if you go there, you'll be able to see it in all its glory.
Yeah. So tell us a little about the other research that you did, because I know you work off many resources. It was like 200 to 400 resources that you typically have.
I do around 400 sources total in a novel, and this one was no exception because I was dealing with some things that I knew nothing about, and that's one thing that attracts me to it, is I don't know anything about it, and I'm hoping the reader's going to know more about it. So I had to learn about the Ghent altarpiece. I had to learn about some aspects of the Catholic Church, which I don't want to say to give away the novel, but some aspects of the Catholic Church that are very interesting and very, very different. Joan of Arc makes an appearance in this book. She factors into this story, so I had to learn about Joan of Arc as well. The Pyrenees Mountains and down in there, the abbey that I used, there's an actual one down there in the Pyrenees Mountains. I changed mine up quite a bit, but I visited that one a couple of times, and so that whole area there is just really magical and amazing. So I had to learn all these things in order to put the novel together, because my niche is I try to keep things about 90% to reality and about 90% accurate. I have to trip it up a little bit, but I try not to trip it up unless I absolutely have to.
Right, right. So I'm just curious what, since you did some research on Joan of Arc, what you walked away with there, because she's a character who some relish as a hero and others say she was crackers.
Yeah, we don't, what as typical of people with her reputation, which is huge, we know very little about her. Almost everything we know about her is wrapped up in legend and not necessarily in fact.
Right.
And so, you know, it's the same with Christopher Columbus. We know nothing about Christopher Columbus. We don't know the first thing about where he was from, who he was, or anything about him, which I explored in the Columbus Affair. There's a lot of aspects to these great historical characters that we just don't know anything about, and the myth has taken over far more than the reality. I did this with Lincoln and the Lincoln myth, when we explored some things about Lincoln that I know most readers don't know about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and Joan of Arc's the same way, but she factored in and worked in very well here. I've been wanting to include her in a novel for a long time, and she fit perfectly here because she went just right with my my Maidens of St. Michael, my nuns that I created.
Right, right. So tell us about those. Tell us about how you created your maidens.
I thought back to the nuns from my childhood who were tough. They were just tough. And I said, well, what if they were a little extra tough? What if they had some skills and things that they could put into place? What if a group of nuns, a group of women started to guard a secret? And they guarded this secret for 2,000 years. And they protected this secret. And it passed down from women to women to women to women until eventually it became a religious order. And that order then evolved into what it was now, the Maidens of St. Michael. So I actually used some real groups that happened in, but it always happened with men.
Mm-hmm.
The Benedictines, the Dominicans, this is how they came about, as they got a purpose and they kept going till they finally became a religious order. But I thought, well, what if the ladies could do the same thing? And and this secret that they have guarded all through the time, and then that's where the Cathars came into play, and Catharism, which I wanted to learn more about. Catharism is a religion that supposedly died 700 years ago. It's gone, but is it or is it not?
Yeah, well, this is what makes it all so interesting, because we really don't know. I mean, if anybody's ever gone to like the cloisters of some convents and monasteries around the world, and all these secret tunnels and secret walls and panels and stuff, we just never know.
You just never know. That's the whole point. And that's what I've tried to. That's what I try to put together. That's the fun part. I mean, that's what I enjoy doing.
Yeah, well, it certainly has all the elements that make a good thriller, like your Cotton Malone series. I love the way that you define the difference between a thriller and a mystery, because these days it's hard to categorize a lot of fiction, because people will go mystery/thriller/suspense, where it used to be clearly identifiable. How do you differentiate between a mystery and a thriller?
It's pretty simple, really. A mystery is about what happened. What happened? And so that's what it's about. You solve the mystery. A thriller is about what's going to happen.
Hmm.
That's the difference between the two. They're not better. None's better than the other. They're just two different genres. And, a mystery, something happens, and you go about solving it. That's all it is. In a thriller, you go about trying to figure out what's going to happen. It hasn't actually happened, and you're trying to prevent it or cause it to happen. So that's the difference between the two. And it's a simple distinction. It gets blurred in books, because some of them involve elements of both of those.
Right.
By and large, I am a thriller writer, because I deal with what's going to happen, not necessarily what has happened.
Right. And what about suspense? Because there's elements of those in everything, too.
That's in both.
Yeah.
I don't consider suspense a separate genre. Mystery, thriller. Suspense is in both.
Yeah.
Suspense goes into both elements of it and factors into both. So I've never considered suspense its own subgenre. I've always looked at it as thrillers and mysteries. That's the genres, and then underneath there's so many. I write international suspense thrillers, so mine is a subgenre of that. They used to be called spy thrillers, but now they have that big fancy new name.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for clarifying that for me.
Yeah.
So you are on book tour right now, right? Because last time we spoke, you couldn't do that. It was all online, but you're actually out going around the country right now?
We did 2 weeks on the road, and we did 14 cities.
Wow,
in
2 weeks.
And we just got back and finished from that. So, yes, I think I was sort of an experiment that Grand Central sent out to see, is the book tour, can it still work? And I'm glad to report that, yes, it can still work. Things were not quite pre-COVID, but not far off either.
Right.
Not far off at all. So I think the book tour is not dead. I think it's still viable. I think it still can work. certainly need some adjustment and modifications based on things in the world, but we made those, and we had a good, successful tour, and I'll head out again. Cotton Malone comes back in February.
Because you've already written that, though, right?
Yes, that one's written. That was written and was done beforehand. Cotton will return in February with a great adventure that deals with Ludwig II and the Bavaria and the fairy tale castles over there. Neuschwanstein, Feinstein, Harem Kimsey, and Linderhof. It's one of my favorite parts of the world. And Cotton gets caught up in a very interesting adventure there. It's called The Last Kingdom, and it'll be out February 21. And then Luke Daniels is going to get his own book next summer. He's getting his own series. He's going to get 3 books, and the first one will come out next summer.
Well, that's very exciting. And, you know, I'm sure there are Cotton fans out there that are glad to hear he's going to be back in February after his mini vacation. But
he just took a little vacation.
Yeah, just a little vacation there. The Omega Factor is the name of the book we talked about today. It's out now. It came out June 7th, and so it's on the bookshelves right now. Steve Berry, it's always great talking with you. I'd like to close my part out with a quote that's at the start of your book. I won't say why, but I really needed to hear or read this this past week. And it's a proverb from Proverbs 26:11, and it says, "Like a dog that returns to its vomit is a fool who reverts to his folly."
Exactly correct.
Steve Berry, listeners can find out much more about Steve and his work and everything that he does. There's a ton of books up there that I didn't even know you did, Steve, like your online ebooks and stuff. Steveberry.org. Final thought you'd like to leave listeners with today?
I'd like everybody to go out and give it a try. I think they'll love it. It's a great summer read. It's a great escape. The Omega Factor's fun, and it's a standalone. So, you know, you'll get a taste of what I do. If you like it, you can check out Cotton Malone.
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to stay a standalone, but we'll see.
That's up to the readers. That's all up to the readers now.
All right. Well, Steve Berry, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, man. All right.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.